Laureen, really excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to be covering a lot. It's going to be fun. But before diving in, why don't we take the first few minutes to introduce our audience to you, have you share a bit about yourself and some of the life experiences that helped jumpstart your career.
So I'm a Bronx girl, was born and bred in the Bronx in New York. At 16, went to college so early, maybe too early, went to Duke, then got a master's at Stanford, and then went back to New York for law school at NYU. So an interesting educational background, but came out here in 1981 and have been working basically in the Bay Area and San Francisco in particular for 42 years. Started as a lawyer, then became a general counsel, worked at some companies that people know like the Clorox Company, Nalcor Puritan Bennett, those great companies. Did that for about 15 years, lawyer to general counsel. And then I moved on to CFO work and have been a CFO for about 25 years and have done taking companies public, a lot of M&A financings. And then I joined FLG in 2011 when I had sold a company as CEO. And I've been doing consulting for about 11, 12 years and been the managing partner of FLG for 3. So that's my background.
Yeah, no, that's great. I really want to jump into sort of that first chapter of your career, you know, because I think your backstory is one of the more interesting ones because I believe your career as a CFO is unparalleled. So it's really fascinating to have learned that you started off your career in law as GC of Nalcor. And I think you've even referred to it as your seminal job. Why is that?
Absolutely. So Nalcor was definitely my seminal job. And there were a lot of reasons for it. But most importantly, Eddie, I had this amazing CEO by the name of Ray Larkin. So let's give him the credit where credit is due. You know, he's just one of those CEOs who phenomenal in sales and marketing, really wanted good people around him in terms of the operations of the company. And he just believed in me. And so every chance I got and every opportunity there was in terms of doing additional C-suite work, he would just say, Laureen, are you interested? So as such, I was able to take on things like HR, like corporate communications, the IT, what we used to call the IT department, and then finance. So why that was such a spectacular job for me, it allowed me to move from just focusing on law to then basically looking at the company, its P&L, its businesses, and kind of helping the business go forward, not just as a lawyer. So great job.
Yeah. And the responsibilities that you had as general counsel, how do you think those translated to the CFO role at that time?
That's a great question. So as a lawyer in a company, you're really looking at all of the legal risk issues of the company, and you're working with all the other C-suite executive officers trying to kind of figure out what's going on, what's working, what's not. But I also, when I was at Nalcor, had a CFO who would have to sometimes drop out for weeks at a time because his wife actually had a chronic health condition. And so he and I just incredibly got along, and he would, let me take you through the P&L, Laureen. Let me take you through the balance sheet. I want you to work with this tax person and that person. And so he would allow me to start like being in meetings with him, taking on some things that were not purely legal. And so it just got me really interested to do more than just looking at legal work. So when we actually sold Nalcor to Mallinckrodt, and this is way back in the day in 1997, I was actually allowed to really start looking at the CFO role and what I wanted in that larger company going forward. I declined because the company was based in St. Louis and there was no way that I was moving out of California, but that was how I kind of was able to kind of broach the CFO role, which is having somebody kind of walk me through it on the job, so to speak. I was really lucky.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it begins and ends with people, right? That's kind of what drives us and motivates us. You kind of mentioned it a little bit there. By the early mid 2000s, it seemed you'd sort of fully transitioned to the CFO role, a role which I imagine at that time was a pretty interesting one to be in. And I'm sure came with many memorable moments. What was it like being a CFO during the dot-com bubble?
I would say it was brutal. After Nalcor, I was a CFO at a very good hearing technology company called Resound. For 2 years, we sold that for a great deal. And then I moved into the dot-com world with more dot-com. many learnings. One was we did not have first mover advantage. Drugstore.com did. So they got out and went public on a $2 billion valuation and did great. The second mover advantage company was Planet Rx, which just kind of squeaked out at a $1 billion valuation. I think this was about 1999, and we could not get out. So the lesson there is don't be the third mover in a space that's getting crowded. And it was a brutal year because we were all ready to go public. Our S-1 was filed, and Merrill Lynch called us to the World Trade Center at the time in early 2000 and said, we can't take you out. The market's crumbling. We are not going to get the analyst coverage that you're going to need. And I'm sorry, but we just can't take you out. And what we heard was, you know, get yourself sold pretty quickly because it's going to be ugly out there. So the good news, though, is we were able to sell the company at a decent price. No one made any money, but it was sufficient enough that the VCs who I was working with said, hey, I would like you to do some triaging of the companies in our portfolio. And this was during that really tough 2000 to 2002 period. So I did quite a bit of that before I jumped into my next CFO position.
Yeah. You held various CFO positions, and it felt like every company you were at was going through its own journey, its own growing pains, and your private financings, restructures, plans to go public, plans to get acquired. So much was going on, and I do want to dive into it all, but let's start with restructures. Which one in that era stands out to you the most?
So restructures have always been a little part of almost every job I had. Not so much Nellcor, but the first CFO job I had was at Resound, which I mentioned. And it was about a $200 million hearing technology, hearing device company, and it was going nowhere. No market cap, no capital out there in the public markets to play with, so to speak. No one was following us. It was tough. And my role coming in was to really restructure the business to get it ready for an ultimate sale, but where there would be value. And what we did there is we kind of stripped about $40 to $50 million in terms of cost out of the company. We closed down a lot of the analog hearing device facilities that were going to be a thing of the past. Restructurings, in my opinion, can be fun, but you have to have the tough stomach, so to speak, to deal with layoffs, what that means to people, so to speak, you know, helping them potentially find that next job. And then just stripping cost out of a company can really cost a lot in terms of programs, people, and that sort of thing. So my feeling is you always have to have the right stomach for restructurings. They can be tough, but in our case at Resound, we got to the right place on OpEx such that when we were ready to sell the company, we actually sold it at a really nice price. It was a very good deal.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of companies can resonate with that, just given what's been going on the past year and a half. A lot of what's been going on is conversations around exits. What can you share with us on what it was like for companies going public or taking them through a sale at that time?
Back in the day, so we're talking now like 20, 22 years back, you know, medical tech in the Bay Area was still pretty strong. So assuming you had good revenue, assuming you had decent gross margins, you were typically going to get acquired at a pretty nice price, whether you were public or private. These days, the market is just very, very different, right? You have a lot of healthcare in a little bit of limbo because of the fact that you have microcap biotechs that are running out of cash and are trying to figure out, should we get acquired? Should we find partners? And at what valuation? Because the valuations certainly aren't as frothy as they were, right, in 2021. So it's really quite a different market. Tech companies, I think right now are doing pretty well. And you do see layoffs, but it's only because they're smartly right-sizing themselves. But the tech market in general, I think, is relatively solid. And then, and I know we'll get to this later, but consumer product companies are really having a tough time right now because of they kind of built up inventory and excess last year. And as such, the market has kind of shrunk in terms of consumer appetite for spending. So that's a whole nother story that we might get into a little bit later.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, just to kind of put a bow on sort of this first chapter in your career, what overarching lesson would you say you've carried throughout your professional journey from that time?
I would say that the thing that most defines me is going into every opportunity or engagement with authenticity. And what I mean by that is I'm a straight shooter. I typically come in with no agenda. I want to always do the right thing. So I'm somebody who will tell the CEO no when he needs or she needs to hear it. I will talk very openly with the board and the audit committee if I need to with regard to where the problems are and how I'm trying to resolve. Another thing I've learned is you never bring a problem to a board or a CEO without a suggestion or recommendation as to the solution. But I would say it's really just being honest about where the problems lie in a business and really kind of helping to resolve them in as kind of authentic and truthful a way possible, because a lot of companies want to sweep things under the rug. They don't want to get to this at some point. They don't want to tell the board because we don't need them to know those kinds of things. And you just have to be a straight shooter. And I would say that's what has kept me going in my career. And I've spent my whole career in the Bay Area. So if you're not that way, that's when you run into trouble.
That's great, Lorraine. I want to skip ahead. You joined FLG Partners in 2011. Why don't you give our audience a brief overview of the firm and how you became a part of it?
Well, first, I will say that the reason why I left what I would call W-2 hardcore assignments as a CFO and a CEO in 2011 was that I was really kind of burnt out and I didn't want to report just to one person, a CEO, anymore. I really wanted to take some time to look at lots of different things, not just in the healthcare sector. And so I thought consulting would be interesting. And I learned about FLG, I think it was through LinkedIn. So I connected with the managing partner then. And I will say the 12 years that I've been at FLG have been far exceeded my expectations. And the reason is because number one, we are a firm that is all about referrals. So all of our work comes in by referral, 40% VCs, maybe 20% private equity firms, and the rest from different groups, be it CEOs, board members, whatever. At any one time, we're 30 partners. We're kind of dispersed one third in healthcare, one third in tech, and one third in consumer products or consumer facing companies. I typically can work in both the healthcare and the consumer facing company sectors. I really don't do tech CFO work. And you can pick and choose your assignments, and you can pick and choose how hard you want to work. So we have partners that are at full capacity working 2-3 days a week. And then we have partners at full capacity working 5 or 6 days a week. So there's a lot of flexibility and I like varied work. So I typically do 1 or 2 assignments at any one time. And typically those assignments are about 12 to 18 months. And then you get to take some time off and go do something else. And the great news about that kind of work is that you have to go in, assess quickly, and then make a big impact fast in the company that you're working in.
That's great. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of many of the people on your team. And I imagine it is quite a busy time for you and your team right now. And I won't go through all the opportunities that you had under the FLG umbrella, but I do want to highlight your time at Hotel Tonight, where you served as a CFO during a pretty instrumental period in the company's life cycle. What can you tell us about your time there?
So I came to Hotel Tonight in January of 2018 and worked for a great CEO who I admire, Sam Schenck, very creative guy. But at the time I came in, they had some issues in the C-suite. They had some issues with their business model. And then they had some issues with regard to how you recognize the revenue and some of the tax issues by being in so many jurisdictions around the country. So I wasn't really coming in to restructure, but I was coming in to basically reevaluate the business plan and the model, reevaluate the metrics with Sam, and are we looking at the company in the right way? And then basically help the company get through those two big issues, one on sales tax and one on kind of how we recorded revenue, get through those, and then really just help to rebuild the company and get back on track, which we did. We had a great year in 2018 and then a very good beginning of the year in 2019. And it was around the end of 2018, we had just done another round of financing where Sam started to get pinged by companies that were interested in merging with us, acquiring us, whatever. And Sam just began a really good talking relationship with Brian Chesney, who was at the time and still is the CEO of Airbnb. And it was just a really nice kind of click together because those were still very heady times for Airbnb. We were doing great. And Airbnb was really interested in getting into the kind of business that we were in, which is hotel stays, not just the traditional Airbnb stay. You know, working with Sam to get that deal done was a ton of fun. Although, you know, it was arduous. We certainly had some impasses at times, but that proved to be a great deal for the C-suite at Hotel Tonight. And then many of the C-suite remained and had larger jobs at Airbnb as well. I think Sam just may have left Airbnb after about 2 years there, where he was kind of head, I think, of the specialty hospitality business, not really sure, but just a great guy. That was a great opportunity coming as an FLG partner into helping Hotel Tonight. And prior to that, actually, I had another phenomenal experience. And that was I was the interim CFO of a company called Rodan and Fields for actually over 2 years and walked into that when they were just under 300 million. They needed to start scaling up because they were growing so rapidly. So that's why they brought FLG in. And in the 2 years that I was there, we went from 300 million to 1.2 billion.
Wow.
And so you can imagine it was hyper growth mode. It was getting new lines of credit. It was just looking at the company with a whole different business plan, metrics, modeling every quarter, but it was a lot of fun. So again, FLG has brought me just some great opportunities.
For companies at critical development milestones, venture debt can serve as a key financing option to foster growth and minimize dilution. Venture debt is intended to complement equity with a solution that is less restrictive and more customizable than traditional commercial bank financing. Hercules Capital is the largest BDC focused on venture lending, with over $13 billion of capital commitments made to close to 600 emerging growth companies since our inception. Hercules is the lender of choice for innovative entrepreneurs and their venture capital partners. Connect with us at htgc.com to learn more.
Thanks for that overview, Laureen, and getting a chance to learn a bit more about your life. Now I want to kind of take a step back here and just discuss the role of the CFO at a higher level. Let's start here. What do you think are 3 to 4 things you think every CFO must have to be successful?
The first thing is agency. And what I mean by agency is you have to know who you are. You're your own person. You have that internal power. And you need that because as CFO, you oftentimes are the governor, so to speak, of what's right and what's wrong, what we can't do, what crosses the line, and that sort of thing. And you have an audience of the board, the CEO, and those others in the company. So agency is important. Gravitas as number two, you've got to know what you're doing. So coming in as an experienced CFO like we do at FLG Partners is super, super important. I would say the third thing is compassion because you need that to be a good leader. You need to know what makes your subordinates tick, give them what they need, and it becomes almost a love affair from the standpoint of they will want to work with you again and again, and you will want to work with them. The fourth is kind of the ability to deliver bad news. So that goes to gravitas and the ability to persuade, but oftentimes you're put in the position where you're going to have to talk the tough talk with your CEO or your board. And so you have to have had the gravitas and the agency for that CEO to listen to you, and you have that ability to persuade him one way or the other. And then the last thing is you just have to be honest, meaning you have to just be very, very honest with, you know, how you comport yourself, your behavior, and all of that good stuff. So I would say those are, to me, the 5 ingredients to be a very successful CFO today.
Yeah, that's great. And it sounds like these 5 ingredients you could have had when you first started, it's just as relevant as it is today. But we've had this conversation. We do feel like the CFO role has changed over the years. Can you just touch a little bit about that and what the main drivers could be?
Yeah. So I remember way back like in the 80s, and it was changing even then. But when I started, a lot of people assumed that CFOs came from a CPA background, the accounting background, and they were just about the numbers. And then the late 80s started with these big leverage buyouts, where oftentimes the CFO was the strategic thinker in making certain kinds of deals happen. And I think that's when people started thinking, whoa, 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 the CFO is not a bean counter. In fact, they don't necessarily even have to be a CPA. I'm not. But what they do need is kind of strategic vision. They have to know generally finance well. And I think that they've become CFOs today are kind of like the conciliaries to CEOs. They're that kind of second in command or that person that that CEO goes to, hey, let's do some modeling or let's do three scenarios, high, medium, and low on where the business is going. Can you look at this business because it's not tracking revenue-wise and tell me why? And if not, then should we keep it? Should we kill it? Should we talk to our VP of sales and let him know he's whatever? So I think that the CFO job has become much more strategic, very conciliary and advice-driven to both the board and the CEO. It's just a great position to be at in a company because you see everything.
Yeah, and I don't think it's ever been more important to be a strategic and advice-driven CFO than in this current fundraising environment. I think there was a report in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago that venture fundraising hit a 9-year low. It's become a lot harder for startups to raise capital no matter where they are in their life cycle. Let's start here. How would you advise companies that had plans to exit this year, exit last year, but no longer can with the IPO window being closed? What would you tell those companies?
So the IPO window's kind of closed for almost every sector of business right now. It's crazy, but it's true. Biotech, you can't go out. Tech, it's hard to go out. CPGs, that's not happening. So it's really across the board. And what I would say is if I were a company that was thinking of an IPO this year or even partly last, you're probably in a position where you're struggling with cash. So hopefully you have gone out and gotten some debt financing or you can do another internal round of financing. It's hard. You need to start realizing that your valuations are not going to be what they were, the frothy valuations of 2020 and 2021. So I would say to those companies, be realistic in terms of your values, because cash is king and you want to bring as much cash as you can in, even if it's a down round, because you then want to conserve your cash to make it through to hopefully a new window in the IPO market opening in 2024. And who knows? The other thing I would say to companies who had plans to IPO and a cash out or whatever you want to call it, look at partnerships, look at M&A. And again, you have to be realistic with the valuation. I think in biotech in particular, there's several hundred micro-cap biotechs that are running out of cash this year. And unless you have real proof of concept or you're in a clinical trial and the drug looks really good, I think you're going to have a hard time in terms of kind of making it through this trough. So that's when I would look for partnerships and M&A deals, even if you're going to take a haircut, a big haircut in valuation. Because again, you want to continue the business, whether it be within a larger company, whether you're getting more capital coming into the company, but at a much lower valuation, or you're able to do some debt financing. But it's a pretty tough market out there right now.
Yeah, tough market. And curious to get your take on companies that are in a position of strength where, hey, we came out of 2022 sufficiently capitalized, strong balance sheet, but need to grow into their valuations and are, in order to grow into them, they're highly M&A focused. What would your advice be as a CFO in sort of that scenario?
So if you are a company that's very strong, like let's say you're a big biotech or biopharma, you're public, you got a lot of cash on the books, man, you could probably do so much M&A and acquire those microcaps that we just talked about at low valuations. If you're a very strong tech company, I would be looking at investing in the future, like for instance, AI or areas where you know there's going to be a lot of growth and you want to get in there, or maybe even acquire companies in those areas. To me, if you're in a strong position right now, I would be looking at opportunities to grow my business or develop new business lines, as I had just mentioned. And then definitely looking at M&A because you can probably acquire several companies or a few companies at much lower valuations than you may have could have a year ago or something like that. So that's what I would be doing if I was a strong tech or biotech company. CPG companies, they're all kind of having issues right now. But if I was a strong CPG company, I would probably spend more time just looking internally in terms of how I can be more resilient because you probably still do have some inventory issues on your hand and you don't want to kind of overdo it in terms of growing out in a fast way that might reduce the cash that you have in your coffers and your ability to be as resilient as you want to be. So that's how I look at those different sectors.
Yeah. Tale of Two Cities is what we like to call it here at Hercules. And when you think about the next 2 years, Laureen, what do you think are going to be the biggest challenges that CFOs are going to have to face?
That's a great question. And it's kind of like an unknown. I think the rest of this year is going to be a lot of blocking and tackling by CFOs, cash conserving, streamlining the businesses and the headcount, making sure that a company can survive over the next 18 months. We all would like to assume that the markets are going to open next year, but we don't know if that's true or not. So again, it's that conserving cash. If you're in the healthcare space and you're meeting your clinical markers, raise as much money as you can because you want to extend out the runway. If you're a tech company, again, as I mentioned, you might do some opportunistic M&A, but I would also be very careful of how I'm spending my money, so to speak, so that I too can conserve cash into next year. And then, as I mentioned with consumer products, to me, it's a lot of defensive posturing right now with those companies as they really need to bleed off their excess inventory, as they need to really conserve cash. They may have to do a lot of streamlining in terms of headcount, but we would all like to think next year the markets are going to open. And so I sit on the board of two companies, and the work that we do at FLG, any company that is hoping to go public next year, you just have to have an 18 to 24 month runway of cash.
That's great. In a period of great uncertainty, you have to just plan ahead.
Totally.
Nothing says that like having a strong balance sheet. So really helpful. Well, great, Laureen. I want to end the podcast with what I like to call a quick fire session.
Okay.
Quick questions, quick answers. Should be pretty lighthearted and fun. What do you think?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
First one, favorite quality in a CEO?
Compassion. If a leader doesn't have compassion, they're not going to be a good leader. So every CEO needs to have that. That's a good one.
One lesson from your career people would benefit from knowing?
I would negotiate the hell out of my compensation package. I did not do that in my career. I'm just being honest. And I know I left money on the table multiple times. So have that agency, have that power, know how good you are, and negotiate the best comp deal you can for yourself, for sure.
Best professional advice you've been given?
So this is an interesting one because this takes me back to that seminal job that I had at Nellcor and that CEO that I mentioned, Ray Larkin. So during one of my performance evaluations, he said to me, you know, Laureen, you're so smart. You're so capable, you know, all of those great things, but you are not a good listener. You're not an active listener. You're always on the next thing when I'm just here or everybody else with you is just here in the now. What I had to do is really learn how to be in the moment and listen. And so I have like little tips that I constantly have for myself to be an active listener, which is I'll stop and say, may I repeat what you have said? So I make sure that I'm listening. People love that because you then get it. And then just again, trying to be in that moment and not always looking for, I got to solve his problem now before he finishes his question or his concerns. So that was the best advice I've ever gotten. Stop, listen, be a more active in the moment listener.
Great one. Okay, last one. What's left to accomplish for Laureen that she hasn't already?
Well, I think what I want to do is after I finish up at FLG, which won't be for a few more years, but after I do, I definitely want to write a book about my kind of 45 years of experience being a woman in Silicon Valley who has had really amazing opportunities. So I need to make it funny. I need to make it exciting and challenging, the book, but that's what's next for me. And then I want to do a book tour.
That's fantastic.
And yeah, exactly. That would be great.
Have to have you back on once you publish. This was a lot of fun. I want to thank you again for sharing your story on the podcast, and all the best to you, Laureen, and your team in 2023.
Thanks so much, Eddie. You've been great to work with. Thank you.